Welcome to Why Do We Do That? A psychology podcast that deconstructs human behavior from the perspectives of social scientists, psychologists, and others that use applied psychology in their work. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Moyer. In this episode, I sat down with behavioral scientist Dr. Colton Scrivener. Colton works in the Recreational Fear Lab at Aarhus University in Denmark and in the psychology department at Arizona State University. Colton's work investigates the evolutionary and psychological underpinnings of morbid curiosity and our fascination with the darker side of life, including horror, true crime, and all types of scary play. In particular, he's interested in how engaging in morbid curiosity and scary play may be beneficial for our mental health and well-being. Colton writes about morbid curiosity on his Substack, Morbidly Curious, his Psychology Today column, Morbid Minds, and is currently working on a book about the science of morbid curiosity that is set to be published by Penguin Random House in 2025. I can safely say that Colton's episode is one of the most fun topics I've ever discussed on the show. As I mentioned in our chat, I am personally extremely curious about morbid topics, taking an interest in true crime as well as the horror movie genre. I've wondered many times if there was something wrong with me having such a strong interest in taboo topics, but Colton's work suggests that this is likely not the case. I particularly enjoyed examining morbid curiosity through an evolutionary lens. We often overlook how modern interests in things like sports or comedy, or in this case, horror, give us a window into what was important for our brains to pay attention to in early human existence. I also appreciated the amount of detail that Colton used in building his morbid curiosity scale. In psychology, we sometimes see researchers claim that they've found a unique or new concept or trait, when in reality, they're just giving a new name to something that already exists, or measuring a concept that is statistically comprised of other well-established concepts. For instance, it might be common to hear someone discuss an individual as being a type A or type B personality, with type A generally describing someone as being uptight, while type B is someone that is more laid back. Unfortunately, there is little evidence to justify these binary classifications. Not to mention that we already have a tool to measure these types of traits called the Big Five Personality Scale. Colton's due diligence on his morbid curiosity test gives me confidence that his work will continue to yield interesting conclusions long into the future. If your idea of a relaxing Friday night is sitting at home with a bowl of popcorn and throwing on a serial killer documentary, this episode is for you. Enjoy. Okay, today I'm joined by Colton Scrivener. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
So Colton researches an area of psychology that I believe you have come up with this term, perhaps, called morbid curiosity. There are lots of different phenomena that fall under this umbrella of morbid curiosity, or as I call it, fascination with the macabre. Could you give us first an overview of the types of phenomena that you look at when looking at morbid curiosity?
Yeah, of course. So I mean, I didn't come up with the phrase itself. I mean, certainly people have used it long before I did. But I formalized it a little bit better for scientific investigation. So like in the scientific literature, there really wasn't any talk of morbid curiosity as a phenomenon. And so I kind of centralized it and gave it an operational definition within psychology in this case, so that we could, you know, more appropriately study it. So what it typically refers to is an interest or intrigue with things that are dangerous. And there are a lot of different dangerous things out there. So it is kind of broad and encompassing, but from what I've found in my research, there do seem to be at least a few different categories that people might be more or less morbidly curious about. So one of those might be dangerous people. This kind of taps into true crime and the minds and behaviors of people who might be dangerous to you.
Right.
Related to that, but slightly distinct, is an interest in violence. So rather than an interest in the individual who is violent, you're interested in the actions of violence, the acts of violence that you see. And this might be something more like, you know, why would someone go to a boxing match, or why would the Romans go to the Colosseum, which is slightly different than why someone might watch a true crime show. A third one, which is, again, somewhat related, but is still distinct, is bodily injuries. And so this is more about the consequences of violence. So if you have, if you interact with something dangerous, there are consequences to that. Bodily injuries give you some clues as to how dangerous that thing is, or what kind of danger it might be. And the final one, which is one that for a little bit I struggled with, but did seem to come out as a clear category in its own, was an interest in the paranormal. And the reason I struggled with it is that, you know, I'm trained in biology, and so I think of things kind of from a functional perspective. I personally don't believe in the paranormal. I don't believe in ghosts. And so to me, it was kind of strange, like, why would we have this, you know, presumably somewhat adaptive instinct or intrigue with things that don't exist? But it turns out there are a lot, we can get into that later, but there are a lot of reasons why that might be, that, you know, a lot of things that are paranormal do tap into things that are similar to dangerous people. A lot of them are agents with bad intentions. They're a bit difficult to study or learn about, which makes them perhaps more interesting to us in some ways. But yeah, so there's these kind of four, you know, domains, I would say, that do intercorrelate, but also people can, you know, score higher in one and lower in another.
Right. I took your morbid curiosity questionnaire, and yeah. Interestingly enough, turns out that I am way above average on most of those domains, except for that paranormal domain. Yeah. And I can see your hesitation about including it. I mean, it does, in a way, an interest in the paranormal does suggest kind of an interest about death. And so I can see why you would put it in there. Something I also read in some of your writing was, you sort of say that our curiosity is more about the danger than the death itself. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Yeah. So again, for many of the human behaviors that I am interested in or think about or research, I initially ask kind of a functional question. Is there a function that this behavior could serve, right? Is there some adaptive function that it could serve? And in many cases, adaptive functions, you know, there's kind of an ultimate reason that something exists, and then there's a proximate reason that some behavior exists. An ultimate reason might be it increases your chances of survival or reproduction from a bird's eye kind of broad view. A proximate reason might be that it's fun to engage in this activity, right? So if you think about like having children, that's pretty much the most direct route to increased fitness from an evolutionary perspective that you can have, right? You have more kids, that's a pretty direct increase in fitness.
Right.
But evolution doesn't make us want kids. In fact, a lot of people get frustrated with their kids, right? We don't have this dying adoration all the time for our kids. We do have a special bond with kids that we don't share with other people, but it doesn't mean that we always want them or even try to have them. Instead, what it promotes is mating, right? Mating is kind of the proximate route to having kids. So understanding danger is kind of a proximate route to avoiding death.
Now, as I look at this scale, I'm curious as to if you think that there is some other phenomena that unifies these categories. It makes sense that they are all related to the, you know, morbid curiosity, but it also, as I look at it, I can see how there might be individuals that are really into the you know, the bodily injury stuff. Bodily injury doesn't bother them, and they also may have a distaste for dangerous people, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you describe the differences in terms of what we would see in the population for how they would score in the different subscales.
So do you mean are there other traits that might influence this, or
yeah,
are there differences among? Yeah. So that was one of the first things that I looked at, right? Because, you know, although I had found that as you mentioned, these things sort of intercorrelate and there might be reasons that they people, you know, have similar feelings about them. They could just be explained by other traits like disgust sensitivity or the big five personality, right? Things like neuroticism or extroversion or agreeableness. So that was one of the very first things I did, was run a very big model essentially on a sample where the participants took not only the morbid curiosity test, but also took a number of other personality questionnaires that I thought might explain this away, right? So I gave them the big five personality, which is openness to experience, agreeableness, extroversion, conscientiousness, and neuroticism. Mm-hmm. I gave them questionnaires about disgust sensitivity, so how sensitive they are to different types of disgust, like contamination or core disgust. I mean, there's a couple of different disgust categories that load onto a single factor of disgust sensitivity. I gave them measures of psychopathy because there had been some suggestions in the literature that might explain, you know, this or explain part of it. I looked at their age, you know, sex, the various different personality traits. I looked at five other measures of curiosity to see maybe, you know, another measure of curiosity might actually, you know, encompass this. And so I put all of these into a model. And what I found is that when I included every single measure, which was again, many, many, many measures, it only explained about half the variance in your score on how morbidly curious you were, which is, you know, half the variance is a lot, but it's not a lot when you're using like six or seven different questionnaires that should explain, you know, all of it if it's not a standalone trait or a standalone individual right. difference. And so I was pretty convinced after that I was at least measuring something that had not been captured by other pre-existing measures of individual differences. So of course, those, you know, some of those things do correlate pretty strongly with morbid curiosity, but on their own, nothing correlated more than, you know, nothing explained more than maybe, you know, 30% of the variance or so, which is pretty good, but it's pretty typical for some personality traits.
Was there anything that surprised you going into this investigation?
A lot of things, which is kind of fun, right? I mean, there were some things that I was right about and some things that I didn't even think about that came up, you know. One of them, which has led to a number of other papers that I've published and studies that I've done now, was that in that study I just mentioned where I gave everyone the different personality traits or different personality measures, there was a measure of psychopathy in it, the PPI, which is often used in non-clinical populations, so it measures subclinical psychopathy. One of the subscales of that is cold-heartedness. And cold-heartedness is sort of a measure of compassion, where if you're high in cold-heartedness, you're very low in compassion. So you have no concern for other people's well-being. It's not even that you dislike them, you just don't care about their well-being. And it's very typical in both subclinical and clinical psychopaths that they have high levels of cold-heartedness. And what was interesting is that people who are morbidly curious did score higher in overall psychopathy, subclinical psychopathy, except for one subscale. They scored very low in cold-heartedness. So they actually had lower levels of cold-heartedness than non-morbidly curious people. And it was very strange to me because typically scales all go in the same direction, even if they're various levels, right? But it was very weird to me that morbidly curious people would score, you know, it would have a negative correlation with cold-heartedness, even though it had a positive correlation with every other subscale. And what that led to later on was me looking at empathy and horror fans, and whether or not, you know, they had higher or lower empathy, which, you know, we can discuss later in the podcast or now, but was one of the.
I was thinking about this because I definitely, in terms of my own personal experience, I'm a morbidly curious person. I like, you know, the horror films, and I've seen all the Saw movies, and I like Hostel and stuff like that. And this is just a subset of the scale, but I never saw I never thought that that related to my level of empathy. And it does bring up this question that I'm sure most people are curious about. You know, you're saying that you're not really seeing a relationship with Cole Hardiness. So could you talk a little bit more about why you think you might not see that relationship in the first place? Why is it that somebody who's interested in these horrific images and in art don't lack empathy?
Yeah. So there are a couple of reasons. I mean, maybe first it's worth mentioning why I thought that could be the case. So also, you know, pretty morbidly curious person, love horror movies.
I must admit, it would be super hilarious if you were not a morbidly curious person. You find yourself nauseated trying to
read by my own research all the time. Yeah, I mean, it didn't resonate with me anecdotally. You know, it didn't resonate with me personally, which is not a good to have evidence, but is a good way to ask research questions. You know, if something doesn't resonate with you anecdotally, it often is a good way to then formulate it into a research question and test it empirically, right? The reason that I tested it at all was because in the 1980s, when slasher movies got really big, there was a concern in the US and the UK both about whether these were bad for people, right? Are they causing people to lose empathy and become mean and cold-hearted and violent even in many cases? And there were a couple of psychology studies published in the 1980s about horror, we could call it like horror, enjoyment of horror and empathy. And what these studies had concluded was that people who enjoyed horror more were lower in empathy. Now what's interesting that, you know, there were only a handful of those studies, and there was a meta-analysis that was published in 2005, and it looked at, you know, these empathy among a number of other traits and how it related to fright media. And one of the things that was really interesting was that when you actually dig into those studies and the methods they used, what they were doing is they were showing people like a kill scene from Friday the 13th, for example, just the you know, maybe 1 minute kill scene that's very violent and gory without any context. And then they asked them, how much did you enjoy that? Now, that's not a great way to see, that's not a great way to measure horror fandom, right?
Sure.
I think the analogy that I often use, it would be like showing someone a breakup scene from a rom-com and then asking them, like assuming that that means that they like rom-coms if they like the breakup scene. Probably doesn't tell you much about rom-com fans, but it might tell you a lot about like sadists, you know, if they really enjoy watching a breakup scene. Oh. Just like watching a single decontextualized violent scene. Yeah, that might tell you something a little bit about someone who's high in psychopathy or low in empathy, but it doesn't tell you much about people who enjoy scary stories, of which violent scenes are, you know, part of that.
Mm-hmm. It's like you're only getting the extremes in that case. I mean, if you're gonna see that little snippet, I would imagine the vast majority of individuals are going to say, I mean, no, I didn't enjoy that.
Yeah.
Decontextualized.
And the ones who did, you know. Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, like with the breakup scenes, like most people aren't going to enjoy just a standalone breakup scene. But if it's put in the context of a story where that's a pivot point in the story, just like a kill is often in a horror movie, it makes a lot more sense. There was then a scientific reason to ask this question, right? And perhaps a scientific reason to believe that, you know, they could be lower in empathy, because that's kind of what the literature suggested, even if the studies in many ways were sort of flawed. You know, another reason that I thought it might not be true is that the only reason that, so a lot of people enjoy horror movies because they are scary, right? Interestingly, not everyone enjoys them for the fright itself, which we can talk about later, but many people enjoy, you know, the thrill or the suspense of it. But a movie is not going to be thrilling or suspenseful unless you are placing yourself in, or you're taking the perspective of the protagonist, right? The reason that a horror movie is scary is because you're imagining yourself in the protagonist's position. Well, if you have little empathy, you're not going to be very good at placing yourself in the protagonist's position, which means you're not going to actually enjoy the horror movie very much. It's not going to be scary to you, and you're not going to enjoy it. So in order for the horror movie to be scary, and in order for you to enjoy that, you actually have to have some, you know, moderate level of empathy in order to empathize with the protagonist, right?
Interesting.
So again, there was kind of a logical problem with this horror fans have low empathy question that led me to, you know, just recently I published a big, I think it was 4 studies looking at, you know, empathy in horror fans across, you know, movies they had watched, how much they enjoyed horror, how much money they donated for various things. And in every case, I found that horror movie fans or people who had watched more horror movies had a roughly the same level of empathy as anyone else. And in some cases actually had higher levels of empathy, like cognitive empathy, for example, the perspective taking aspect of empathy. So yeah, I found no evidence that there was lower empathy, in particular, no evidence of lower affective empathy, which is more of the, you know, feeling what another person feels.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, when you were talking about you have to have a certain level of empathy to even understand the material and the dynamics of the story.
Or for it to resonate with you, to matter, right?
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting. And it relates to another idea I was thinking about with all this, which is, I'll just call it cognitive flexibility, which is, mm-hmm. you know, I think of, there are some people that can still listen to Michael Jackson music, even after all of the accusations against him and the crimes that he's allegedly committed. And then there are other people who are they're not capable of separating the two. I now have this knowledge. I can't separate the music from the information. I'm curious if you think that something similar can happen with this morbid curiosity, such that, you know, it requires sort of a, I don't know if it's cognitive flexibility or if it's emotional intelligence, but I'm able to say that this is fiction and I can separate the fact that it's interesting from an artistic standpoint, but I can still say that these, if this were real, all of this is morally wrong and terrible.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, just because you watch or enjoy something violent on a video game or a TV show or a book for that matter, doesn't mean that you approve of violence in the real world, right? Fortunately, you know, even though we can get sucked into simulations of worlds in our stories, we're still pretty good at telling that they are stories and not the real world. We're not hallucinating, right? We actually can understand that these are fictional scenarios, or even if it's a real scenario, like a true crime case, you can understand that, you know, you're watching it on TV. You're not actually in the actual thing. I do think that you're right about the cognitive flexibility. I don't know. I also don't know if cognitive flexibility is the most accurate term, but I think it captures the idea, right? That, and it may even have to do with empathy, right? There's a difference too between your ability to empathize and your ability to modulate your empathy in different scenarios. You know, if I'm a surgeon working on a patient, I actually want to tone down my empathy a little bit. Because it could interfere with my work, right? And that's actually why, if you see someone doing surgery, let's say on like your stomach area, they cover the face, they cover everything, but like the area that you're working on. If you were trying to enhance empathy during surgery, you would show the patient's face, because that's one way that we actually empathize with people. But in that case, it's actually not useful for the person helping you to empathize, right? So it's actually good for the surgeon to be able to regulate their empathy up and down, depending on what their situation requires. So it is possible that maybe horror fans are better at maybe they have average levels of empathy, but they're actually better at down-regulating it in order to engage with the story when it's needed. So like during the kill scene, maybe they can kind of down-regulate the empathy in order to not feel so averse to it, right? And then they can regulate it back up later in the story. I don't know if that's the case, but that seems very plausible to me. And it seems like something that has not been looked into very much, not just in horror, but in empathy research in general, sort of your ability to modulate this rather than just as a static trait that you have no control over.
So what do you think accounts for the polarization related to morbid curiosity? Now, first of all, I don't know if this actually exists, but it seems to me that people have strong reactions about, for example, horror films. Like I love them or I hate them. Do you see it play out that way in the data? And if so, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it does seem to be kind of bimodal. You know, like you said, that people kind of enjoy it or don't enjoy it. There's not a lot of people who are fence sitters when it comes to that. And I think it's because people can either, you know, can become immersed in it without becoming overwhelmed, or they can't, right? Some of that has to do with emotion regulation, maybe this empathy regulation. Some of it has to do with morbid curiosity. But yeah, it's difficult to be in the middle because a horror film is a very emotionally charged film, right? So it's difficult to kind of just feel apathetic about them. So yeah, I my guess is that it has to do with, you know, there are a number of sort of, I guess when it comes to entertainment, there's a number of entertainment options for you. And if it's either easy for you to become immersed in and enjoy and be curious about a horror film or a true crime story, or it's not. And so you just don't see a lot of people sitting through it kind of in the middle like you might with a drama or an action movie even.
I want to go back and
it's kind
talk
of, it's kind
little...
of like, it's kind of like comedies, right? Like you either find a comedy movie funny or you don't. There's not a lot of in between with comedy as well. It's like you either get the jokes and they're funny to you or they're not.
I want to go back and talk about the evolutionary reasons or possible evolutionary explanations for morbid curiosity, because yeah. You know, the default thought I have is we're supposed to have disgust because mm-hmm. disgust signals that we need to avoid something. Mm-hmm. If you're a child and you lack disgust and you start and you come across a carcass of an animal and you start playing with it, that's a major risk to your likelihood of reproduction.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about what the evolutionary story is that could potentially explain why morbid curiosity would exist in today's populations?
Yeah. I mean, in some cases, disgust is not involved. And so setting those aside and thinking about the cases where like bodily injuries or even violence, where disgust might be involved, why would we have this, right? I think that, you know, I you asked if I was surprised by anything earlier in our chat. And I think this is another thing I was surprised by, is that disgust sensitivity actually doesn't correlate very strongly, if at all, with morbid curiosity. And even with the bodily injuries, right? You would expect that bodily injuries would be basically subsumed by disgust sensitivity. And I think what's going on there is that two things. One is that there's a difference between an infectious injury and a non-infectious injury. And in many cases, we can tell the difference. And two, many of the disgust studies in psychology only ask about how disgusted someone feels about something, and they don't mm-hmm. ask about other things that might be explaining it, like empathic pain, because we don't really have a good word in English for empathic pain, right? You know, that's not a phrase even that you hear often. Like empathic pain is just not a phrase you hear often, but it is a thing that we do, right? I feel pain when, you know, if you were to fall and break your leg, I feel pain towards that. Now, if it's bleeding, a disgust researcher might ask, how disgusted do you feel by that? And empathic pain subjectively feels pretty similar to disgust. And so we might say, yeah, I feel pretty disgusted by that. But what we might actually be feeling is empathic pain. And there's some empirical evidence to suggest that's the case. So Tom Kupfer, who's a psychologist, did a set of studies, really, really interesting studies a few years ago that where he found that people can distinguish between infectious injuries and non-infectious injuries, and they have different attitudes about them. So he did a series of tests, you know, the first one just being like asking people about their disgust towards infectious injuries and non-infectious injuries, and found that while they did correlate, they did also lump together in separate ways, almost like a factor analysis where you have disgusting injuries and infectious injuries and non-infectious injuries. People reported that they felt disgust towards both, but they reported them in different ways, if that makes sense. And then he did a really fascinating study where he essentially, in his lab, he set up some biohazard trash cans, like what you put, you know, needles or other used things in, and biohazard bags, and put gauze in there with fake blood on it. And then he put a photo of an injury on the outside of it. And what he did is he had some of these biohazard trash bins and photos that were infectious injuries and some of them that were not infectious injuries. So for example, one of them might, of the infectious ones might be gauze from an injury where a man had an eye infect, had an eye effect infection, and in a non, sorry, that was an infectious one. A non-infectious one would be a man who gauze from a man who had a fish hook stuck through his eye, right? Mm-hmm. We would label both as disgusting, and in fact, people do label both as disgusting and gross, right? But how do people behave when they come across these? So what he did is he brought people in, told them that these were from the hospital, that we were doing the study. I forget what his whole spiel was, but essentially a study on disgust or something, or study on medical something. Had people put on gloves, had them rate how disgusting they felt about each of these. In every case, people rated the two items pretty much the same. So they reported the same level of disgust towards the gauze from the infection, gauze from the fish hook injury. But then he had people reach in, select one to reach in and actually touch the gauze with their gloved hand. Now, if people actually felt the same level of disgust towards both, you would find that that's just a random distribution, right?
Right.
But of course, as you probably can expect, like most people selected the non-infectious injuries to reach in and touch, right? If they had to choose, they would reach in and touch the non-infectious one. So despite, you know, if disgust really is about aversion, you know, preventing you from coming into contact with infection, which I think it probably is, that actually makes a lot of sense, right? Because if we know something is infectious, we're going to avoid that. But if something is just an injury, those often look very different from infectious wounds, right? You can kind of tell when something is infected. If you go to the doctor and you show them a cut, they can kind of, I mean, they're medically trained, but there are differences in the way it's maybe smells, even if it's been infected for a long time, the way it looks, the type of injury it is. So there are a lot of ways that you can distinguish these things. And so I think what's going on is with the bodily injuries, it's not about infectious injuries. And in fact, in the questionnaire, the morbid curiosity questionnaire, there might be one question about a toxin or something. What's interesting is that actually loads onto that factor lower than any other item, which confused me for a long time. I thought, well, that's like a pretty clear, you know, example of a bodily injury. But I think what's going on is it's actually loading onto something like infection and disgust sensitivity. Mm-hmm. So I think there are these two different types of injuries that we, you know, can distinguish in many cases. You know, if I fall and break my leg, there's not really strong cues of infection there, right? And in fact, if you instinctively avoid injuries like that, then we wouldn't have treatments for these things. People would just avoid you if you fell and broke your leg. They wouldn't actually come to help you because they would feel like they should avoid you because you're infected, right?
Right.
So I think we're, you know, our minds are a bit more sophisticated when it comes to that than we sometimes give them credit for. Mm-hmm. Even if we don't have a word in our English language that clearly delineates infectious disgust from something like empathic pain.
So let's transition from what you might consider gore and bodily injury to true crime. Obviously, in the last 20 years or so, true crime has become increasingly popular. One of the interesting things that seems to come up around true crime is that true crime is something that is especially attractive to females compared to males. So could you talk a little bit about what you see, if there are gender differences and mm-hmm. what is really driving so much of a curiosity around true crime?
Yeah, so there's less empirical research on true crime than you would expect, given how popular it is. And by less, I mean almost none, which, again, really strange. But I felt the same way about morbid curiosity and horror movies when I started researching this. There was almost nothing being done on it, which blew my mind because it was such an interesting feature of our culture and like something that's very popular in many ways. And yet nobody was asking why we were doing these things. Mm-hmm. And I think people ask that about true crime, but the scientists aren't really asking that, or at least they're not doing the studies on it. There's one study I can think of from maybe 10 years ago. It was Amanda Vickery and Chris Fraley, I think, at University of Illinois. They did a study on true crime, looking at gender differences and why people were interested in it. In this case, I think they focused on podcasts and maybe books. True crime shows weren't really as big, I think, in 2013 as they are now. Anyways, what they found is that yes, there does seem to be a gender difference, such that, or a sex difference, such that women are more interested. Men and women are both interested in true crime, women slightly more so. And they measured this by things like measures on, I think it was like measures on Goodreads or ratings on Goodreads or ratings on Amazon. So for example, men were more likely to rate books about war and women were more likely to rate books about true crime or serial killers. Which is, you know, indicative that they maybe read them more. They also looked at different variations of how stories were told. So if a story talked about a woman who, or a person, I think they varied man and woman, but a person who escaped from a killer, if the story focuses on the trick that the person used to get away, rather than some other feature of the environment, people were more interested in it, and especially women were more interested in it. So it does seem that women are a bit more curious or a bit more tuned into dealing with potentially dangerous people than men. I find it also in my measure of interest in minds of dangerous people, that sort of subfacet of morbid curiosity. It's the one subfacet where women sometimes score higher than men, or at the very least score roughly the same. And some of the others, like bodily injuries, men score a bit higher on average. Violence, especially, men score a bit higher. Paranormal is kind of mixed as well. But again, paranormal deals with a lot of the same factors as minds of dangerous people. Anyway, so why might that be? That's still kind of an open question. I can speculate on it a little bit.
Why don't you? Because it does strike me that there is very little research on this topic.
Almost nothing. So if I can speculate a little bit, I mean, there is some good research showing that women tend to be more interested in other people generally than men are. Like, they're more interested in the psychology of other people, they're more interested in the behaviors and the minds of other people, and so it makes sense that they would also then be more interested in the minds and behaviors of dangerous people, right? That's probably part of the explanation. Another part of the explanation might be that on average men are a bit more physically formidable than women, so that if they find themselves in the presence of someone who's dangerous, they might feel a little bit more physically capable of escaping, and so they don't feel like they need to prepare maybe quite as much as women do. Another one might be that almost every case of true crime deals with a male killer or a male suspect. And in many cases, it's a male, not every case, but many cases, it's a male suspect who is killing or harming women. And so they can identify with that a little bit better than a man might.
It would be fun to do this research too, because, you know, there are a lot of true crime stories where it's just sort of, a mother harms her children in some way, shape, or form. Yep. And there's some other true crime where it's not necessarily a killer. It's just, some sort of self-defense type story that ended really badly.
Well, and two of the most famous serial killers killed boys, right? I mean, or men, young men and boys. So Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy didn't even attack women. So it'd be interesting to see if women are more interested in those stories, or if that maybe, men are more interested in those two than they are perhaps like someone who mostly preyed upon women.
I want to transition to another aspect of this topic, which is recreational fear. So you kind of brought it up a little bit earlier, where suggesting that, you know, there some people get different benefits from being scared, and mm-hmm. some of your writing focuses on haunted attractions and this idea of recreational fear. Could you talk a little bit more about your interest in that area?
Yeah. So I think that term came about with a paper a study that I did with some people at the Recreational Fear Lab, which I've affiliated with we probably did the study back in like 2018 and maybe got it published in 2020. But it was a study at a haunted house or a haunted attraction, like a Halloween haunted attraction in Vejle, Denmark. And what we were interested in was how people had fun when things were scary. Like, you know, it seems like a paradox that people would have fun when they're being intentionally scared, right? So we measured things like heart rate and took videos of them and tried to capture all these different ways that people had fun. And the term we came up with for that was recreational fear. which is obviously different than truly being afraid, right? I think, you know, there have been a couple of definitions tossed around in recent years about what recreational fear is or might be. Very recently, a member of the lab, Jens, he wrote a pretty good, thoughtful discussion of what a good definition of recreational fear might be. And it's essentially, you know, gaining enjoyment out of an activity that produces fear-like emotions, which could include fear, anxiety, dread. And that doesn't have to be a direct, you don't have to derive enjoyment directly from the fear. You could also derive it from indirectly from fear, meaning that like some people, like adrenaline junkies, for example, actually derive their enjoyment from the suspense and the high sensations and the, you know, fast heartbeat, the sweaty palms, everything that you think about when you think about things like skydiving or bungee jumping or these high adrenaline activities. One way to get enjoyment out of that is to actually enjoy the sensations themselves. Another way to get enjoyment indirectly from the fear is, you know, if you go through a fearful situation, you may not necessarily enjoy those high sensations, but when you complete it, when you finish it, you think back on it and you feel very good that you survived it, that you were able to get through it, that you did better than you thought, right? It's kind of a self-confidence boost. And in that way, you know, it requires some kind of fearful activity that is still recreational in order for that enjoyment to come about. And so I think both of those cases are still encompassed by recreational fear, but for very different reasons. So we call, you know, the former type of person, we call adrenaline junkies, and the latter, who derives enjoyment mostly from feeling like they've, you know, grown personally or learned something about themselves, we've called those white knucklers. And that comes from clenching your fists in fear and kind of the white from the blood escaping across your, mm-hmm. your knuckles.
How malleable do you think this pairing of fear and enjoyment is? I know I know that when I was in middle school, I could not stand roller coasters. I would wait in lines and then I'd dip out of the line before I even got into the ride. Yeah. And then I would go on, I would eventually build up the courage. I'd go on it, and through multiple exposures, my personal story, it feels as though I've transitioned to actually enjoying it. It used to be I only enjoyed getting off the ride, and now I think I actually do enjoy the ride. Of yeah. course, I'm just telling myself that this is a story I tell myself about how I've evolved my interests. But do you think that this disposition is malleable?
Yeah. So anecdotally and qualitatively, when we've talked to participants in these empirical studies, that's a very common story where people kind of start out more of a white knuckler, right? And they're doing it to see if they can get through it. And then over time, many of them find reasons to enjoy it, whether that's through the sensations and they sort of evolve into more of an adrenaline junkie, or through other reasons. You know, with the horror community, there's a pretty tight-knit community, so you get a sense of groupishness or coalition from that. You know, you get a sense of like you belong or a kind of an identity from that. So it's something that we've not looked at, but I think myself and everyone in the lab has been wanting to look at is that, you know, do you move through these types of horror fandom over time? I think the answer is almost certainly yes, but it's not clear if everyone does it, if only some people do it, if you can move backward. You know, my intuition is that many people who are very high in sensation seeking start out as adrenaline junkies and kind of remain that way. And people who are lower in that, in sensation seeking, but still morbidly curious, are more of a white knuckler situation, or another type that we've found called the dark coper, who uses horror to kind of deal with difficult emotions. You start out as one of those and you kind of move over time into something more like an adrenaline junkie, or at least less like a white knuckler. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what you described, right?
So my last question relates to something you just said. In the grand scheme of things, do you feel that there is incremental benefit from being morbidly curious?
Yeah, I think there certainly was for most of human history, right? You see this even in animals, right? Animals engage in prey animals engage in something called predator inspection, where they sometimes stop and actually just observe their predators and watch what they do, right? Now, it's obviously much more dangerous in the animal kingdom outside of humans to do that because, you know, zebras don't have movies and books and stories, and so they can pretty much only directly observe predators, which comes with its own kind of danger. It would be like if you were trying to find a serial killer out on the street and watch them. That's a lot more dangerous than watching a true crime show. Mm-hmm. So I do think that, you know, there certainly has been an advantage to it. I think there still is, maybe for different reasons. Most of us are not ever going to encounter a serial killer, or if we do, we're not going to be the target, right? So I think the benefits have probably shifted in some ways, but I think that there's still potentially an emotion regulation benefit. And this is something we've looked into a little bit with when COVID happened. We looked at, you know, do horror fans deal with the uncertainty surrounding COVID better than non-horror fans? The answer seemed to be yes, that they were more psychologically resilient to that. And I think that comes from the fact that when you engage with something scary for fun, what you're doing is you're not passively consuming it, right? If I sit on my couch and I watch a drama movie or a comedy, it's a little bit more passive. You kind of just watch it, you know, and you don't actively engage with it quite as much. Maybe a drama movie in some cases, but in many cases with movies and TV shows, you kind of just passively consume them. With horror movies, especially if you're more of a white knuckler, you have to actively regulate your emotions, because if it becomes too scary, it's no longer interesting or fun and you don't want to do it, right? So what you do is you actually regulate how afraid you feel. We've found this in haunted house. These people do this too. So for example, if I'm going through a haunted house or watching a horror movie, there are some techniques I can use, both behavioral and cognitive, to down-regulate how afraid I am. One thing I might do is I might cover my eyes. That's a very stereotypical horror movie behavior. Something comes on the screen, it's a little too much for you. What do? Cover your eyes, maybe, you know, plug your ears so you don't hear the screams, whatever it might be. What you're doing is you're down-regulating how intense the fear is, how intense the stimulus is. There are other things you can do cognitively, like you can remind yourself it's just a movie, it's just fake, right? It's going to pass in a few minutes. You could look up spoilers to it so that you're not too surprised. But what you're doing in each case is you're trying to regulate how anxious you feel and how afraid you feel. And I think many of those strategies, you sort of implicitly build strategies for regulating fear and anxiety, right? Like covering your eyes in the real world isn't very helpful, but doing it during the horror movie might help you then learn how to regulate your fear, regulate your anxiety in other ways. And those strategies might be able to be used in the real world, in real situations. I mean, that was kind of our premise for this COVID paper, was that people who played with fear more often through horror movies, haunted houses, books, things like that, learned how to deal with feelings of uncertainty, feelings of anxiety, which were super abundant for everyone in COVID, which may explain why horror fans were, and morbidly curious people were, more psychologically resilient during the early months of the pandemic when things were very uncertain and nobody really knew what was happening.
Well, it is an absolutely fascinating area of research, and it seems as though there are lots of fertile ways to continue moving forward with this this line of research. If you want to take the morbid curiosity test, you can go to ColtonScrivener.com. It's very interesting. Thank you so much for being on today, Colton Scrivener.
Thank you.
For more on Colton, visit ColtonScrivener.com. That's ColtonScrivener. ScrivenER.com, or subscribe to his Substack at morbidlycuriousthoughts.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please share an episode with two of your friends. Head over to patreon.com/whydowedothatpodcast to become a paid supporter of the show. You'll gain early access to episodes as well as bonus video content. Follow on Instagram or Facebook at Why Do We Do That Podcast, or Twitter at WDWDTPod. As always, feel free to email me with comments or guest suggestions at whydowedothatpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, this is Dr. Ryan Moyer,
hoping you found some answers to the question, why do we do that?